We're gonna take a trip right now. Like we always do about this time.
This is a journey into sound. Break it
down. I'm Kyle Lone, and you're listening to Cultural Manifesto. On this week's show, I'll speak with the musician and storyteller Shanta Nerula, the sister with the sitar. Shanta grew up in Chicago, and during a college trip to India in 1969, she discovered the sitar.
I heard the sitar for the first time, and I just fell in love.
Shanta has spent the last 50 years integrating the instrument into her blues and jazz compositions. She'll join me on the second half of the show to share tracks from her album, Sitar Black, and discuss her work advocating for women in music.
That's been my mission all the way through decades now, to lift up women in music and to draw attention to us.
Up first, I want to pay tribute to Reverend Dr. Marvin Chandler, a legendary Indiana jazz musician, civil rights activist, and minister. Chandler passed away in September at the age of 93. I'll share some examples of Chandler's music, and we'll listen back to excerpts of my 2020 conversation with Chandler.
To me, it's all an adventure, every phase of life. And I look back on the whole thing and look at where I am now, and it's an adventure.
I recently spoke with the Indianapolis Deputy Mayor, Judith Thomas. Thomas is a passionate advocate for the legacy of Indiana jazz music, and she also has a family connection to Chandler. I asked Thomas to share her thoughts on the life of Reverend Dr. Marvin Chandler.
Yes, of course. Dr. Reverend Marvin Chandler, otherwise known as Uncle Marvin to me, I got to know him simply because through marriage, we're related. His sister, Marcella, was married to my uncle Herman, my mother's brother. And so when he moved back to Indianapolis, that's when we became connected. We would go over. He just was an amazing man. He played at my wedding. When my son passed away of a rare genetic disorder as an infant, he wrote a song about him. I haven't listened to it since. I attended Uncle Marvin's funeral recently, and well, really his celebration, because he was a true Christian and a believer in faith and hope and peace. And I think that's what drove him through his life to help others, to be inspirational. He worked very closely with the theologian Howard Thurman, who was an amazing man and an amazing teacher to so many. And I think that he was always a positive person, always looking to uplift people. I mean, you just talk to him, and the way he talked, it was just uplifting. Mm-hmm. And so it's a great loss. Indianapolis needs to celebrate him. I believe that, you know, he's from Bloomington, and that family, that entire Chandler family, I can't tell you the impact they had on probably thousands of students at Indiana University, people that came to Indiana University from other cities and would come to their church just down the street from IU and celebrate with them and eat at their table. My mother, before her brother married Marcella, would go and sit at the Chandler table and find family and love and acceptance. And that's what he comes from. And that's what his family's about and continues to be about. And I'm grateful to even be connected to him, let alone the musical talent and the beautiful way that he played along with Everett Green. And he's just a wonderful man and will be missed.
That was Indianapolis Deputy Mayor Judith Thomas sharing her thoughts on the life of the late Marvin Chandler. Up next, I want to share an example of Chandler's music. Over the last 20 years, Chandler enjoyed a successful collaboration with the great Indianapolis jazz vocalist Everett Green. We'll listen to a track from their 2002 release, I've Got Love. This is Looking for Someplace to Be, featuring Houston Person on sax.
Every now and then, I'll wonder if I'll ever find what it is I am after. I've been everywhere, looking for some place to be. I have sailed on every ocean.
That was vocalist Everett Green and pianist Marvin Chandler with Looking for Some Place to Be. Chandler passed away earlier this year at the age of 93. Reverend Dr. Marvin Chandler was born and raised in Bloomington, Indiana. Chandler started playing piano at age 4. His prodigious talent was noticed by Hollywood producers who offered Chandler a chance to perform with the Cabin Kids, an ensemble of child actors that appeared in several feature films and shorts during the 1930s. Chandler declined. He stayed in Bloomington, where he performed with his two sisters as the Chandler Trio. They became local radio stars in the 1940s and local television stars in the 1950s, hosting a weekly program for WTTV4. During my 2020 conversation with Chandler, we discussed his early years in Bloomington. You grew up in Bloomington. You lived there until adulthood, correct?
Oh, until adulthood.
Yeah. I know you went to a segregated school in Bloomington. This was the era of segregation. What was life like for black families in Bloomington during that period of time?
It was great. We had a ball. We paid no attention to color things. The only thing was when you went to the theaters, we had one theater that had places in the balcony for black people to sit and white people. But all the white kids that I grew up with came up in the balcony with me because they said, it's better up here. You can see more. We didn't really pay too much attention to segregation in Bloomington. And we never felt deprived. And what's so funny, and I think everyone can attest to this, in most communities across this country, you had official public segregation. But there was a lot of integration going on behind the scenes. And there were a lot of illicit relationships, things of that kind. And we used to laugh at all this because you'd see all these public figures and we all knew who they were going with and what they were doing.
And Reverend Chandler, you mentioned that you didn't want to leave your family and go out to Hollywood to become a child star. But did you see music as part of your future as a young person? Is this something you knew you wanted to explore in your later life? Or were you just having fun playing music with your sisters?
I was just having fun. That's been the way it's been ever since.
And it seems like your music making has been divided between two worlds, the church and jazz. Is that correct?
It depends on what kind of church you're in.
Yeah, okay.
Some of the Pentecostal churches I went to, you could
all one.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, the music, I still think. And I remember years and years ago, somebody asked me in a radio interview how I could put these two worlds together. I never thought they were apart. I still think that jazz is a legitimate expression of our love for life. And isn't that what religion's supposed to be about? I just think that you can't separate religion from life itself. Some of the church people, of course, more conservative people told me that we were all going to go straight to hell. but we couldn't. And so I used to say that. I'll never forget this. People would say, well, how could you be doing that? And I said, well, isn't it all God's music? I mean, music comes from God. And I really, my theology at that time, which I didn't recognize as theology, but it was that all of life is one and that music was just a wonderful expression of our humanity.
As a young adult, Chandler became interested in social justice in the church. He participated in Dr. King's March on Washington and worked as a mediator after the 1964 Rochester race riots in New York. Chandler lived in Rochester during the 1960s. He worked with the Rochester Area Council of Churches. In 1971, Chandler's work as a peacemaker led him to the Attica Correctional Facility in New York. Chandler served as a mediator during the Attica Prison Rebellion.
71 was a turbulent year for the nation's prisons. At Attica, New York State Prison, more than 1,000 inmates erupted in a volcanic orgy of mayhem, arson, and hostage seizing. It took 97 hours to quell the rioters. And when it was over, the death count was 43, 32 inmates and 11 employees. Prone or dead, they lie, ending the Holocaust.
And Reverend Chandler, I did want to ask a little bit about your work outside of music, right?
Mm-hmm.
Your work in the church brought you into a lot of incredible situations. And you mentioned that segregation didn't hit Bloomington, but you ended up spending some time in places where segregation and racism was really destroying people's lives, right?
Oh, yeah.
And
sure.
Through your work with the Council of Churches in Rochester, New York, mm-hmm. you were involved as a mediator in trying to negotiate peace in some very tense conflicts, uprisings in the city of Rochester. And you were also a negotiator with the prisoners during the Attica prison mm-hmm. uprising. Tell me about some of your work in the civil rights movement and any thoughts you want to share on that.
I look back on it and I think to myself sometimes we get caught in these situations without even – I didn't plan to be involved in the way that I was, but I just happened to be there. I remember at Attica, I was working as a Council of Churches executive, and I was working with the black community of Rochester at that time. I get this call saying that they wanted us to come down to Attica, and I didn't even know where. I said, "Where is Attica?" I had no idea what it was. So we get to this place, and this here, it looks like a medieval prison, and we get in there, and then we had to sign a release before we went out there that if we got killed, the state would not be responsible. And they said, "Well, are you sure you want to do this?" And I said, "Certainly." And they said, "But you know, this yard is full of murderers and rapists." And I mean, they were describing these men. And for some reason, I think the good Lord helps us to discern an important fact. And that is that every one of those guys out in there was some mother's boy. And that somewhere along the line, something had happened, and they ended up where they were. Sometimes they weren't even guilty of what they had been accused of. Often they were. But when I look at those guys, as I look at all people, and I see, well, Everett, tell you, both of us, we've seen all kinds of people, some of whom had business suits on, and they were as low as you can get, and some people who had jeans and, who were really royalty. So you can't tell from the outside.
You had a family at this time. You had a wife and kids, right?
Oh,
did
yeah.
you have any fear or apprehension about going into this conflict and not being certain of the outcome? Yeah.
Oh, I was scared to death. I mean, aside from the fact that that you're going to get there and the people are going to get something happen. Yes, I thought about my wife and my daughter. I had three daughters, and they were little kids. And I thought about that. But I thought, I got to do this. I mean, there's some things when you go into the situation, you know that it's costly and dangerous and risky. But you got to do it. I mean, what else are you going to do? But I'll never forget, because I saw guys going in there and I saw guys getting shot. I mean, it was pretty bad. It was pretty bad. And I saw them dragging men that we'd been talking to, dragging their bodies out. Still haunts me.
Chandler left a mark in many different fields during his life, including music, the church, and social justice. I ended our conversation by asking Chandler about his legacy.
Reverend Chandler, a couple times when I've asked you to characterize a certain record you played on or something you were involved in, you said you didn't analyze it too much, right? Mm-hmm. I'm curious, though, as you reflect on your legacy, how do you want that legacy characterized? As a minister, as a musician? Do you have any thoughts on that?
All I can think of is, I know it sounds trite, but I'm a kid. To me, it's all an adventure, every phase of life. I look back on my childhood, that was a wonderful adventure. As I grew a little older and went through high school and so forth and adolescence, all of that, the terrible, you know how it is, those days when you didn't like anything and didn't like yourself, that's all an adventure. And I look back on the whole thing and look at where I am now, and it's an adventure. It really is. So the psalmist who said life is a blessing was right. It's a good thing. It's something that feeds life itself. Your life feeds life. Life feeds you. So that there, you know, we're all at a great spiritual banquet, and all of the stuff that we go through becomes part of it. There's some salt in there and some pepper in there, but there's some sugar in there too.
We've been listening back to my 2020 conversation with Reverend Dr. Marvin Chandler. You can hear our full talk in the Cultural Manifesto archives at WFYI.org. Chandler passed away earlier this year. He was 93 years old. We'll end this tribute to Marvin Chandler with a solo piano piece. Off his 2002 Christmas album, When a Child is Born, this is Silent Night. Cultural Manifesto will return after this short break. I'm Kyle Long, and you're listening to Cultural Manifesto. Up next, I'll speak with the musician and storyteller, Shanta Nirula, the sister with the sitar. She'll be performing at the Hey Nani Women's Jazz Festival in Arlington Heights, Illinois, on Thursday, January 4th. Go to heynani.com for more information. Shanta grew up in Chicago. During a college trip to India in 1969, she discovered the sitar. And for the last 50 years, Shanta has incorporated the sitar into her music making, including the all-women jazz ensembles Sojourner and Samana, and her current project, Sitar Sis. Shanta has a distinguished career in the Chicago jazz scene. She's a member of the legendary AACM, the Association for the Advancement of Creative Musicians. And she's worked with prominent jazz artists, from Nicole Mitchell to Junius Paul. Shanta will join me in a moment. But first, let's hear a track from her 2017 album, Sitar Black. This is A Message, A Vision.
God gave you your life for a purpose. It's those things you came here to do. May you be aware of your purpose, be able to carry it through.
That was Shanta Nerula's Sitar Sis with a message, a vision, from the 2017 album Sitar Black. And Shanta is my guest this week. We recently spoke via Zoom. Let's join our conversation. Shanta, thank you so much for taking time to join me today.
Thank you.
You've had an extraordinary career as a musician, storyteller, and I think all-around cultural force. Today, I'd like to focus on your work in music. From what I read, you grew up immersed in arts and culture in Chicago. Your great aunt, Nanny Strayhorn Reed, was a classical pianist who worked professionally in music. And as a child, you were part of a youth dance ensemble that performed on national television on the Ted Mack Amateur Hour during the 1950s.
Right.
Tell us a little about your background and your childhood and the role arts and culture played in your life at that time.
It was everywhere, and I was blessed to be immersed in it with piano lessons from my great aunt and studying with Tommy Sutton at the Mayfair Academy. He was one of the premier tap dancers who was a childhood friend of my father. When they were young, they would hang out at the Regal Theater when Bojangles was in town. They would go by the stage door, and when he could, Bojangles, Ben Robinson, would come outside and teach steps to the kids. And that's where Tommy Sutton learned some of his tap steps. And he went on to be a professional and open this dance school in our neighborhood. And so I was one of the first students in his school. And he took us everywhere he could, including on the Ted Mack Amateur Hour.
Geritol, America's number one tonic. Geritol, the fast-acting, high-potency tonic that helps you feel stronger, fast, presents Ted Mack and the original Amateur Hour.
And here is your host, Ted Mack.
Here we have Peggy Sutton, Grace Duncan, Meta Anderson, Wanda Parrott, Velma Neal, Renee Jones, and Cheryl Turner. They're all from Chicago schools. They call themselves the Junior Mayfair Dancers. And there they are.
So the combination of piano and tap really, I believe, gave me my foundation, as well as my parents making a concerted effort to expose me to as much as possible. I mean, going to concerts, I was able to see Errol Garner, Nancy Wilson, Ramsey Lewis, a lot of people who came through town. You know, I saw them as a child. I was imprinted, especially with jazz.
Did you think about performing as a child? Is that something that you had dreamed about at that time?
No, never did. Never did think about performing. As a child, I was dreaming of being a doctor. I had pictures of Ben Casey on my wall. You know, I was headed in another direction. And when I went to college, I thought I was going to be a psychology major until I took Psych 101. That was the end of that.
I want to ask about your time in college. You had a transformative experience during your junior year. You went to Pune, India as part of a study abroad program. And I think you went there initially with the intention of researching the caste system in India. But you had an experience, a musical experience, that completely altered your plans and I think ultimately changed your life. Tell us about this experience you had in India.
I heard the sitar for the first time after being in India only a few weeks, and I just fell in love. And I argued with the director of our study abroad program to change my topic. And obviously I won that argument, got an instrument, found a teacher, and spent the remaining months, about 5 months, studying music, taking lessons and going to concerts. I was really fortunate that Pune, as it was called at that time, was a center of music in Maharashtra state. And there was a big festival going on while I was there. So I was able to attend a lot of concerts and experience the communal nature of Indian classical music, which was really fascinating. I just fell in love with not only the music, but many aspects of Indian culture.
You had the opportunity while you were in India to study with a prominent composer, sitar player, and academic, Bhaskar Chandavakar. Tell me about that experience of studying with him. That was a really unique opportunity, I'm sure.
Yes, he had been a student of Ravi Shankar. Mm-hmm. And he had been to the United States. He had had experience teaching other Westerners, so he was open to the idea of me studying with him. And he had this studio that was adjacent to his home. And I would go there about twice a week, you know, had contact with his wife and his young son, who was actually afraid of me. I cut quite a different figure there in India. I was tall, thin, brown, with a huge afro, and I attracted a lot of attention. It was a really just a calm, wonderful experience of primarily, I would have likened it to a call and response kind of teaching method. There was not a lot written down. He taught me basically my first raga, taught me the notation for it, and he was impressed with the way I caught on. I was one of his best Western students, I must say.
So you come back to Chicago after this trip, and from what I understand, you brought a sitar back with you, but I've read that you were hesitant to play the instrument here because in India you'd been told that you needed to dedicate many years of your life to studying the instrument. And I understand it was the great jazz musician Phil Coran that really encouraged you to incorporate the sitar into your music making. Is that correct?
Yes, I often quote him. When I first went to Brother Phil, I took my bass, which I had been studying just for a short while with Pete Cozy. And Phil had a Saturday morning gathering, which he called this, it was a class, his black music workshop. And I asked him if I could join this class with my bass. And he said, well, sure, but what other instruments do you have? And I told him I had a sitar, but I couldn't really bring it out because of, you know, because I hadn't been studying it long enough. And he said, sister, that instrument's from Africa. So are you. Bring it on over here. That quote, you know, what he said and then what he did to encourage me and open me up and write music for me just gave me permission to express myself and explore the instrument in my own way rather than feeling handicapped or constrained by my lack of Indian classical education.
To ask you about finding your voice on the sitar. It sounds like Phil played a role in that. How long did it take you to kind of get to a point where you felt like you had bonded with this instrument and were able to communicate with it in the way you wanted to?
Well, it started really in India. Even though I was doing my lessons from Sri Chandravakar, but I was also exploring. I was playing quote-unquote Negro spirituals in my little room in Pune. I was fooling around with it. I was trying to figure out what I could say on it early on. And even when I got back home to Chicago, I was playing along with Ruth Brown blues records. You know, I was exploring. It didn't take long, you know, especially when I got with Phil and just was set free, so to speak. Thank you. and it has just continued to evolve. I'm still discovering things. I'm still not satisfied. This thing called music is a lifelong pursuit. I expect I'll never be satisfied, but I'm going to keep on studying and trying and growing.
Your work on the sitar was beautifully documented on a 2017 album titled Sitar Black, performed by your group Sitar Sis. It's a wonderful document of your musical vision. How meaningful was that project for you, and to be able to kind of showcase your work on the sitar in such a profound way?
Well, thank you for the compliments. It was everything. It was the first time that I got to record as a leader, and I have to thank the Chicago Department of Cultural Affairs and Special Events. I think I got that right, DCAES. I was able to do the project as a result of a grant from them.
I'm Kyle Long, and you're listening to Cultural Manifesto. My guest this week is the musician and storyteller, Shanta Nerula. Let's pause and listen to another track from her 2017 album, Sitar Black. This is Phantoms. That was Shanta Nerula's Sitar Sis with Phantoms off their 2017 album, Sitar Black. And Shanta is my guest this week. She'll be performing at the Hey Nani Women's Jazz Festival in Arlington Heights, Illinois on Thursday, January 4th. Go to heynani.com for more information. Let's return to my conversation with Shanta as we discuss her advocacy for women in music. You'll be playing at the Hey Nani Women's Jazz Festival on January 4th, and you've been part of these two all-women jazz ensembles that you mentioned, Sojourner and Samana. I know at one point you were also working on a book about Black women in music. Can you tell me a bit about your efforts to center the presence and history of women in music, especially Black women, and is it meaningful for you to perform at events like the Hey Nani Women's Jazz Festival?
Well, my interest in women, Black women in music, began early on when I was looking for role models, and the only one I could instantly find was Alice Coltrane, whose music I absolutely loved, and she was my hero. But I'm like, where are the other women, you know? So I set about looking. I had a quest. I was looking for the women in music, and I was going to write the book. The book never got written, but I did write a number of articles that got published in various magazines and journals. And I went to New York two or three times, and I was able to interview and hang out with Mary Lou Williams, Janice Robinson, Oh, gosh. Well, Sharon Freeman, Akua Dixon.
I heard you met Elizabeth Cotton.
Elizabeth Cotton in Washington, D.C. Oh, that was great.
That's amazing.
In California, Vi-Red. And yes, Alice Coltrane.
Wow.
Patrice Rushen. I'm drawing a blank because there was, you know, just lots and lots of women I was able to interview and spend time with.
Do you still have plans to finish that book?
Yeah, I go back to it from time to time. Some of the tape recordings, I've lost track of. I have the transcriptions of most of the interviews, and some of them are on Onion Skin, if you even know what that is, and they are unreadable.
Wow.
I don't know if that book will get written, but I did write a nice piece about those interviews in the M3 anthology. Are you familiar with Mutual Mentorship for Musicians?
No.
Okay, it's a program that started during the pandemic of Jin Shu and Sarah Serpa convened a cohort of usually 12 women musicians from around the world that come together virtually, exchanging ideas and support, and then creating compositions together. So I was in their second cohort, my composing partner. They commissioned duos to create music, and my composing partner was Gandavia Doraswamy. We did a piece together. And also, another part of the M3 commission was not only to do the composition, but also to write an essay or to make a contribution to an anthology. So each cohort works with an editor to create an anthology. And so my piece is, I think, called Searching for Women Musicians. And it talks about my quest and has a number of photos. I think you'll find it interesting. And then the following year, Mutual Mentorship for Musicians, also known as M3, gave me a Lifetime Achievement Award and put on a festival. And their festival was in New York. And it was the first time I got to play in New York after almost 50 years of being a professional musician. You can hear me choking up. It took that long for me to get to New York. So that shows how vital their program, how necessary their program is, and how ignored and discriminated against women musicians still are today. And there are a number of programs that are advocating for gender equity, especially in jazz, but also in other areas of the music industry. That's been my mission all the way through. Decades now, to lift up women in music and to draw attention to us. Because still, you can go to festivals sometimes, even the Chicago Jazz Festival. You could sit at the Chicago Jazz Festival some night and not see a single woman on the stage. Or you might see a singer. So they're getting a little better, but women are just generally overlooked. They're discriminated in the academies. They're discriminated on the bandstand, they're harassed. This is a sorry and terrible and unacceptable state of affairs still. So this festival is a great thing to be happening, and I'm very pleased to be a part of it.
And Shanta, our listeners can learn more about your work and purchase your music at your website, shantastoryteller.com. Are there any final thoughts you want to share before we go?
Yes, I would like to encourage everyone to support live music. Tear yourself away from your screens, please, and go out and hear the people who have toiled for years developing their craft, their skill, their art. Go out and support the musicians. Support the youngsters who have talent. Encourage the schools to keep or reinstitute their music programs, and especially encourage the girls to play instruments, not just the flute. let's keep music and the arts alive, because a lot of the problems that we have in our society would not be existing if the arts were considered as important as they are to health, mental health, and human survival. Thank you.
Shanta, thank you so much for taking time to speak today. It was an honor to speak with you. I'm a huge fan of you and your music, so I really appreciate your time today.
Thank you so much.
That's all the time we have for this week. Thank you to my guest, Shanta Nurula. Listen, download, and subscribe to the Cultural Manifesto podcast at WFYI.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Let's end with another track from Shanta Nurula. We'll listen to My Eyes, her recent collaboration with the bassist and vocalist Ganavya Doraswamy. Cultural Manifesto is hosted and produced by me, Kyle Long. Thank you for listening.
Some months ago, I...